We're very fortunate tonight to have Professor Matthew Lockhart from SMU Philosophy Department, and he'll be presenting to us on some paradoxes of epistemic closure.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. This is a pleasure to be with you tonight. This is my first time participating in the Dallas Philosophers Forum activity, so but I'm still, you know, I'm new to this, so I appreciate you bearing with me. I've just prepared a kind of extemporaneous talk on a topic in epistemology that I'm working on. That's my area of specialization is epistemology, about 10 or 15 years ago, some issues kind of came into focus for people working in epistemology that have generated an immense amount of discussion. And so much so that it's impossible for me to cover it adequately in, you know, 40 minutes. But I thought I could just provide you with maybe something of kind of an introduction to this set of philosophical topics surrounding epistemic closure. and I look forward to hearing your questions at the end of the talk, so figure about 40 minutes, and then I'll look forward to hearing your comments and questions and feedback, criticisms, and so forth. So, does everyone have a copy of the handout? I tried to distribute those. Okay, we've got a few extras here, so if anyone comes in later, we can hand those out. I think they'll be helpful, because I'm going to be talking about lots of numbered, you know, kind of propositions and cases and things like that, and it's easy to get lost without something in front of you. It's easy for me to get lost without something in front of me. Gettier only published because he kind of had to get tenure, ended up being this, this huge, making the huge waves in epistemology for the next 30 years. Philosophers basically unanimously agreed that Gettier had shown that justified true belief isn't all there is to knowledge, that something more has to be involved. But philosophers have never since been able to agree on what the fourth or fifth or whatever additional conditions there must be. So if you ask, well, what in addition to justified true belief does knowledge require? The answer is nobody knows. As far as we can tell, there's no unanimity. There isn't even a majority view as to what in addition to justified true belief propositional knowledge it involves or entails. Okay. So I think that's why I say on the handout, I think the propositional knowledge involves justified true belief. I think Plato's conditions are necessary conditions on having what, you know, we ordinarily think of as propositional knowledge, but they're not sufficient, as I think Gettier showed. What else is necessary for knowledge is, you know, anyone's guess, I think. But hopefully this kind of ballpark conception of propositional knowledge will work well enough for us tonight. Okay, so the other question is, what's entailment? Okay, and I give this isn't a very sophisticated version of entailment or very sophisticated gloss on entailment. The way I'm going to use the word entailment in this talk, I'm just going to say one proposition. Proposition P entails proposition Q, just in case if P is true or if P were true, then Q would have to be true as well. Okay. This is a little bit loosey-goosey, but I hope it will work well enough for our purposes. I see on the handout this is a semantic notion, so as soon as you start talking about truth, you're talking semantics as opposed to syntax. So if this was a formal logic class, I might want to have some more sort of sentential. I'd want to talk about the structure of sentences in formal logic and talk about how those sentence structures can be manipulated and give some theory of implication or formal deduction or something in terms of syntactic structures. That's way too technical and narrow and so forth for our purposes tonight. It's more narrow than the notion of entailment that philosophers working on this problem have tended to assume. So I'm going to assume, or I'm going to use a notion of entailment according to which P entails Q if and only if P is true, then Q must be true as well. Now I say, by definition, truth is closed under entailment, right? So given what I say entailment is, I say P entails Q just in case if P is true, then Q must be true as well. So to say the truth is closed under entailment is to say if P is true and P entails Q, then Q is true as well. And that just follows by the definition of entailment. Okay, so trivially, truth is closed under entailment. So shouldn't knowledge be closed under known entailment as well? Before we get into question before I tackle that question directly. I just want to say one thing about this parenthetical remark I have in my formulation of the closure principle. So that parenthetical remark says, so the principle says if S knows the P and it knows the P entails Q, then P knows or is in a position to know the Q. I guess I need to say two things. First of all, why do I say S has to know that P entails Q? Why can't we just say if S knows the P and P does entail Q, S knows or is in a position to know the Q? That's one question. The other question is, why don't I say S is knows or is in a position to know, so that's kind of waffly, the Q, rather than just saying S knows the Q? Well, let me take the first point first. The reason I say if S knows the P and knows the P entails Q, then S knows or is in a position to know the Q. Instead of saying if S knows the P and P does in fact entail Q, then S knows or is in a position to know the Q. If we just said that it's de facto entailment, not known entailment, under which knowledge is closed, then it would be extremely implausible. Okay, so let's go back to what I say entailment is. If you think that entailment is what I say it is, if you think of it the way I think of it, then it's going to turn out that every necessary proposition is entailed by every proposition whatsoever, right? So pick your favorite proposition. How about the proposition, the moon is made of green cheese? There's a good proposition. That proposition entails that 1 plus 1 is 2 on my account, right? The only way it couldn't is if the proposition that the moon is green, if it could be the case that the proposition that the moon is made of green cheese could be true, well, the proposition of 1 plus 1 equals 2 could be false, but the proposition of 1 plus 1 equals 2, in my view, I think it couldn't possibly be false. So it's going to be entailed by every proposition whatsoever, including false ones. So it's going to be trivially entailed by every proposition. Okay, or taking our math one, the cube root of 8 is 2. Okay, so let's think about the closure principle. I have a 2-year-old son, he's just starting to talk. And I think he knows some things, right? So, for example, I think he knows I'm his daddy. So he points to me and says, Daddy, I think he knows I'm his daddy. Well, the proposition that I'm his daddy entails that the cube root of 8 is 2, right? Given what I say entailment is. Thus, if the closure principle said that for every individual S and for every proposition P and Q, if P does in fact entail Q, and S knows that P, then S knows or is in a position to know the Q, then it would follow that my 2-year-old son knows or is in a position to know that the cube root of 8 is 2. And, you know, brilliant as I think my son is, so like any biased parent, he doesn't know that the cube root of 8 is 2. And he's nowhere near being in a position to know that at this stage of his development. And so I think it's more plausible, I mean, what he clearly also doesn't know is he doesn't know that it is entailed by the proposition that I'm his dad, right? So I think the closure principle only has a chance of looking plausible if we say that it's not to say that knowledge is closed under de facto entailment, but it's closed under known entailment, which is to say, if S knows the P and knows the P entails Q, then S knows or is in a position to know the Q. Okay, so that was the first point. The second one is, why did I have this waffly bit about S knows or is in a position to know the Q? Why not just say S knows the Q? Well, here again, it could be that you know, so for example, I think it just can take some work sometimes before you figure out the entailment relation, right? It might be that you know the P and you know the P entails Q, but you don't yet know the Q just because you haven't thought about it yet. You haven't put the two things together to carry out the relevant inference and conclude the Q. So it could be that you know the P and you know that P entails Q, but you don't actually know the Q because you simply don't believe the Q yet because you haven't just bothered to think about it. You're in a position to know the Q, maybe, if you do bother to think about it, but just because someone hasn't bothered to carry out the relevant inference and think about Q doesn't mean that that would constitute a violation of the closure principle. Okay? So that's why I say it's that if S knows the P, you know the P entails Q, S knows, or is at least in a position, if S thinks about it, to know the Q. Okay, that's the formula. Okay, so that's the principle. And why do philosophers think that this is so plausible? Well, I think a lot of philosophers think, well, how could this fail to be true, right? How could you possibly generate a counterexample to this principle? I mean, suppose you know that P entails Q. What that means is you know that if P is true, then Q must be true as well. Now, suppose you then learn that P. I mean, so now you know that P is true, and you know that if P is true, then Q is true. Surely you're in a position, if you just reflect on this, right, to know that Q is true. I mean, it seems like it should be obvious. And in fact, although I don't know that philosophers explicitly formulated this closure principle until relatively recently, I think it's only in the last 15 years or so that philosophers have really been debating this principle explicitly. But I think it's implicit in philosophy for centuries and centuries, and especially in debates over the status of skeptical arguments. I think that in the background of a lot of debates over sort of classical skeptical arguments, there's the assumption of closure of knowledge under known implication. And we'll get to that in a minute. Okay. So that's the principle. That's kind of what all the key terms mean. And that's the basic idea behind why most philosophers think that it's true. But, as I say, there have been some various punitive counterexamples to the principle that have been proposed in recent years. And the first one I have here on your handout is what I'm going to call the car case. Okay, so I say, suppose Phil arrived at the restaurant an hour ago, had dinner. Okay, he arrived for the dinner hour, and Bill parked his car in the parking lot, comes in, has dinner. Okay, so I say, atypically for a philosopher, Bill is not prone to forgetfulness. Indeed, he remembers exactly where he left his car. And as a matter of fact, his car is exactly where he left it, okay? Before any philosophical doubts intrude, okay, before we're perverted by, you know, philosophy, and we're just engaged in ordinary, normal conversation, I said, I think it's very natural to say that Bill knows where he's now. He knows where his car is, right? He knows that his car is in the parking lot. And I've called the proposition, I guess as Bill would put it in the first person, my car is in the parking lot. I call that proposition lot, okay? I think that's a natural thing to say. I mean, Bill parked his car an hour ago, and he remembers exactly where he left it. Nothing weird has happened. Seems the most natural thing in the world to say. Bill knows that his car is in the parking lot. However, Bill, being a philosopher, is a reflective fellow, and he realizes that that proposition lot entails the following proposition, which I call not stolen. It's the proposition that my car, as Bill would put it, my car has not hasn't been stolen in the last hour and driven away. You see? There's no way for that first proposition to be true without that second proposition also being true. So lot entails not stolen. Okay, now let's assume just some very normal things. So assume building park, you know, right here where he can see his car through the window. Suppose he hasn't been watching his car on a security monitor or anything, and he just parked his car, went away, and hasn't laid eyes on it since, hasn't talked to anybody who's just come in from the parking lot and about, you know, hey, you see my car, I'd want. Suppose he hasn't thought about his car in the intervening hour, okay? So I say, suppose he only knows Lot because he remembers where he left his car an hour ago. It seems odd, I think, to say that he knows that his car hasn't been stolen in the absence of any evidence specifically to that effect, okay? So Bill, if he were to wonder whether or not his car has been stolen, he might say things like, well, it's really unlikely to have been stolen, relatively safe part of town, he might even quote a statistic on the odds of this. Maybe he's a fanatic for, you know, demographic statistics or something, and he says, you know, cars are stolen in this neighborhood from this parking lot at a rate of one in every, you know, 100,000 or something. So suppose he has excellent reason to think that his car hasn't been stolen, but it's of a very general sort of probabilistic kind, of the sort that you would invoke to support your belief that your lottery ticket's a loser before you scratched it. Just as you might think that you can't know your lottery ticket's a loser until you scratch and look, similarly, it seems implausible to say that Bill actually knows that his car hasn't been stolen until he looks and verifies that it's still there, okay? That's an intuition a lot of philosophers have. But if that's so, if it's accurate to say that Bill knows the proposition lot but doesn't know the proposition not stolen, then that would be a counterexample to the closure principle. It looks like he would know that his car is in the parking lot. He would know that that entails that his car hasn't been driven out of the parking lot by a thief. Yet he would not be in a position to know whether or not his car has been driven out of the parking lot by a thief. Okay, that's a counterexample one. We'll call that the car case. Okay, just for fun, you know, what's philosophy? Can't do something. It's a little. Can't talk about some kind of outlandish case. I have another one here that's from philosopher Fred Jetsky at Stanford. He writes, he describes a case that I'll summarize this way. So suppose Fred sees some animals in a pen at a zoo. It looks to Fred as though they're zebras. Okay, so Fred believes and thereby comes to know the animals in the pen are zebras. Right? He's just walking by, sees these striped animals, they look for all the world like zebras. He says, "Lo, zebras. There are some zebras in the pen." Now suppose that Fred knows that that proposition, zebras, implies that the animals in this pen are not mules cleverly disguised as zebras. Okay. In fact, they're not mules so cleverly disguised as zebras so as to be visually indistinguishable from zebras. So maybe the zoo is running low on funds, their actual zebra population has dwindled, and mules are cheap to come by, get a little black paint, a little white paint, scissors to trim the mane is necessary. I mean, you know, do you know that some very clever, you know, and creative and dishonest zoo curator hasn't done this to, you know, replenish the completely depleted supply of, you know, zebras in the zoo? Here again, it might look like if you describe the not mules proposition here specifically enough, you can actually make it, you can just engineer the case, right, to make it so that it looks like it's a proposition that Fred couldn't possibly know, at least from his current vantage point, right? So as the case is described, it looks like initially it's natural to say, it's important for me to emphasize the animals in the pen really are zebras, right? The question is whether he can rule out the possibility that there are these cleverly disguised mules instead. So it looks like Fred knows that the animals in the pen are zebras. That's initially, you know, again, before any philosophical doubts intrude, that seems like the natural thing to say. But that proposition, which I call zebras here, entails this proposition not mules. It entails that the animals in the pen are not mules cleverly disguised so as to be indistinguishable from zebras. So if we're inclined to say that Fred knows the former proposition but not the latter, that again would be a counterexample to the principle that knowledge is closed under known entailment. Okay? So those are a couple of, there's actually lots and lots. As far as I know, the best book on this topic is, I should have included a reference to it on the handout, is a book that was written in 2004 by a philosopher who's now at Oxford named John Hawthorne, called Knowledge and Lotteries. And I don't know of anyone who's better at spotting these kinds of potential counterexamples all over the place. He sees them everywhere in sort of ordinary life. They're not, most of his examples aren't as outlandish as the zoo case. The car case actually kind of comes from him. So it's not just two examples here, but if you study Hawthorne, Hawthorne's pretty good at convincing you that these kinds of cases are just thick on the floor. They're all over the place. So what do you do? How should we deal with these kinds of counterexamples? After all, this seems like an awfully plausible principle. If you know that P entails Q, then you know that if P is true, then Q must be true. And if you know that P is true, how can you fail to know that Q is true, right? How can you not be in a position to know whether or not Q is true? So it looks like a plausible principle. We have these putative counterexamples. What are we to do? Well, I said I'm going to give you two not-so-subtle responses and two subtler responses to these counterexamples, these putative counterexamples. And the first is just skepticism. So I think I say on my handout, in talking with students, I found this to be the most common response to these cases. Generally, I'm viewing skepticism with my intro to philosophy students at SMU right now, and you ask them a question like, do you believe you're sitting here in a classroom having, you know, listening to a philosophy lecture, and they're too bored to answer. Okay, they think, of course, why are you wasting our time with this? Why did I enroll in this class? When's the add-drop deadline? I mean, right, it seems utterly obvious to them. Yes, of course I know I'm listening to a philosophy lecture. But then you ask them something like, well, how do you know that you're not being deceived by an evil demon? Right? You present them with something from Descartes' Meditations and say, how do you know that none of these skeptical scenarios is true? How do you rule them all out, right? Can anybody do that? And I'll have a few attempts, but for the most part, people will say, oh yeah, I guess I can't rule out that possibility. Maybe I'm plugged into the matrix, they'll say. So then you go back to the question and say, so do you know that you're listening to a philosophy lecture? And by and large, they go, nah, not really. So it seems like that is I'd say, I don't know percentages, but it's a heavy majority of students are skeptics, basically. They encounter these cases, or if I'll sometimes run these two cases, the car and the zoo cases, by them. And by and large, the students just say, I guess I don't really know where my car is parked. Yeah, I don't really know that that's a zebra. For all I know, it might be a cleverly disguised mule. For all I know, my car's been stolen. For all I know, I'm a brain in a vat, and the cart's evil demon is deceiving me. So I guess I don't really know any of this stuff. What I say on the handout is that I think that, you know, when it comes to the zoo case or even the car case, I think skepticism seems pretty benign, really. First of all, I guess I should stop and say, you realize skepticism does maintain the closure principle, right? It says you can't know the entailing proposition without also knowing the entailed proposition, and since you don't know the entailed proposition, it must mean you just don't know the entailing one, right? So closure keeps the P and Q on the same epistemological footing, and just says you don't know either one, okay, in these kinds of circumstances. So it's one way of respecting the closure principle. And I think that, again, when it comes to cases like the zoo and even the car case, they're kind of contrived examples, you might think, and you might think, no big deal. But I say, I think, thinking about this a little bit more, especially in the context of skepticism, it makes this, you see, this isn't a very benign position to stay with. In fact, I think if you swallow skepticism as a way of dealing with closure, it looks like you're going to have to swallow it whole and accept a very thoroughgoing skepticism about all empirical knowledge. So to go back to the brain of that scenario, is everybody familiar with this? So how do you know that, you know, last night when you were asleep, you weren't anesthetized, your brain removed from your body and taken off to a lab somewhere where it was hooked up to a bunch of electrodes and you put in a vat of nutrients to preserve it and stuff, and you were hooked up to a computer that's generating all of these, you know, sensory experiences you've had since then, okay? How do you know that hasn't happened? How do you know that that's not where you, in fact, are right now? How do you know you're listening to a philosophy lecture and that you're not an embedded brain in a lab somewhere, okay? It's a gory scenario. how do you know that? Okay, now suppose you say, well, I can't know that that's not true. For all I know, that is what's happened to me in the last, you know. For all I know, maybe I am a brain in a vat. But look, take an ordinary empirical proposition like the proposition that here's my hand in front of my face right now. Okay, I call that proposition hand on the handout. It looks like that the proposition that here's my hand in front of my face right now entails that I'm not a handless brain in a vat, right? There's no way for the former proposition to be true without the latter one also being true. So if you adopt skepticism here, then it looks like you don't know that here's a hand in front of your face, and what goes for the proposition hand here goes for the proposition that you're listening, that you're in Dallas, it goes for the proposition that you have a body, it goes for the proposition that, you know, pick your favorite empirical proposition, and we can hook up one of these kinds of cases where it looks like that empirical proposition that you cherish entails some skeptical scenario that you can't disprove, and then it looks like you're going to have to swallow skepticism whole hog. You swallow things whole hog? I don't know. You're going to accept it. You have to accept it and just be an out-and-out thoroughgoing skeptic, okay? So although skepticism, as I say, seems benign when we're talking about isolated cases, when you see where this is leading, it's hard to prevent this from just eroding the view that we have any knowledge whatsoever. So like most non-skeptical philosophers, I feel like this is to be avoided at all costs. So let's move on and see if we can do better, okay? So that takes us to the next possible response to the case, which has come to be known as dogmatism. Another name for this would be Morian dogmatism, I guess, after G. E. Moore. So here's, here's what the dogmatist says. I guess this is at the right under the heading of two not so subtle responses to cases. The dogmatist says, sure, you know that your car has that your car's in the parking lot, and you do know that it hasn't been stolen. Okay, so whereas the skeptic says you don't know either of these propositions, the dogmatist says you know them both. I say this is sometimes called Morian dogmatism because G. E. Moore famously wrote this paper called Proof of an External World, in which he sought to prove an external world by saying, here's one hand, Here's another. Those were his two premises. His conclusion was, therefore, there are now at least two ends. I said, done. Thank you very much for your time. And that was his proof. I think most philosophers have looked at this and said, what? That's not a very satisfactory proof of an external world. I mean, can you imagine, anybody, and any of the, you imagine Kant being impressed by this? I don't think he would be. But it's a possible view. You might just say, look, I do know ordinary empirical propositions, like the proposition that my car is on the lot. I know them with it. Moore's position was, I'm more certain of those propositions, ordinary empirical propositions, than I am of any philosophical argument to the contrary. And so he just said, look, I know that my hands are here in front of my face. I know that with greater certainty than I know just about anything else. So, the proposition that my hand is here in front of my face and tells I'm not afraid of that, I guess I know that I'm not afraid of that. End of story. Okay. Now, I think that, I think there's a couple of problems with the dogmatist response. The main problem with the dogmatist response to cases like the car case is that I think it just doesn't have a lot of plausibility, right? I mean, it seems a little unsatisfying to just kind of stamp your feet on the podium and just say, end of story. It seems, dogmatic, I guess, hence the name. It just seems unsatisfying. And we have this problem, right, which is, suppose you're going to maintain that you do know that your car hasn't been stolen since you last saw it an hour ago. We have this problem of saying, well, how do you know it? I mean, again, as we described the case, I guess we had an individual in mind named Bill. And as we described the case, Bill had no contact with his car in the intervening hour. He didn't even have contact with anybody who had contact with his car. He just remembers where he left it an hour ago. How is that giving him knowledge that his car hasn't been stolen? So we have this question for the dogmatist. How does Bill know that his car hasn't been stolen since he last saw it? I mean, if it has been stolen since he last saw it, wouldn't the evidence upon which his belief that it hasn't been stolen be exactly what it is now? It looks like his evidence is insensitive to the possibility that his car has been stolen in the interim. So it doesn't look like it's good enough to give him knowledge that his car hasn't been stolen in the interim. So where do you get off, dogmatist, telling us that he knows that his car hasn't been stolen in the interim? Okay, that's kind of objection number one, is it just seems implausible on the face of it. For the probabilistically adventurous, there's another little objection that goes like this. Looks like Bill has some evidence that his car is in the parking lot, right? And his evidence is something like his memory of where he parked it. Now the question is, how is he going to use that evidence to infer that his car has not been stolen? Okay, it looks like what Bill's trying to do is take his knowledge of where his car is and his knowledge of the fact the proposition that his car is in the parking lot entails that his car hasn't been stolen, driven away in the last hour. He's going to try to put those two things together and infer that his car hasn't been stolen, driven away in the last hour. Okay. Let's think about what happens in these kinds of cases, in just ordinary cases, using a little bit of probability theory. Okay, so, one thing I just want me to introduce is the difference between prior and conditional probabilities. Okay, so, suppose I tell you I just drew a card at random from this normal deck. What's the probability that it's a heart? You'd say 1 in 4, right? Now suppose I say, I'll give you a little bit of evidence, it's red. You'd say, okay, now the probability that it's a heart conditional on that evidence is 1/2, right, 0.5. Wow, 40 minutes went fast. So it looks like the conditional probability of the probability of the car being a heart conditional on its being red is higher than the prior probability of it being a heart. So far, so good. Now, suppose that you have two propositions. One of them is a proposition like Shamu is a whale, and one of them is a proposition like Shamu is a mammal. It looks like the former entails the latter. Now, suppose you don't know whether either of these propositions are true, but you get a little bit of evidence that the first one is. Okay, so for example, you learn that Shamu is a warm-blooded, air-breathing, aquatic animal. Okay, scaleless, air-breathing, warm-blooded, aquatic animal. Well, it doesn't prove that Shamu is a whale, but it narrows down the possibilities significantly, and it drastically raises the probability that Shamu is a whale. So the prior probability of Shamu being a whale is much, much lower than the conditional probability of Shamu being a whale, conditional on that evidence that Shamu is warm-blooded and so forth. Well, the proposition that's entailed by the proposition that Shamu is a whale, namely the proposition that Shamu is a mammal, is also going to go up when you get this evidence, right? So it looks like that's a normal case where you have one proposition, you get a bunch of evidence that supports it, and you use your knowledge of the fact that the first proposition entails some other one to come to know, or at least to come to have greater confidence in the entailed proposition under deductive inference, okay? But in cases like the brain in a vat case, this doesn't work at all. Why? Because the evidence you're relying on is exactly the evidence that you should expect to have if you are a brain in a vat. Okay, so in cases, it's an elementary theorem of probability theory that where some phenomenon is predicted by a theory, and then that phenomenon occurs, that raises the probability of the theory, right? This is how scientific theories are basically confirmed. So the problem is that the conditional probability of me being a brain in a vat on this evidence that I have a hand in front of my face is actually higher than the prior probability of me being a brain in a vat. And all this math here on the page is just to show you that when you get this evidence that you have a hand, it raises the probability that you have a hand, but it also raises the probability that you are a brain in a vat. So how can it be used to prove that you're not a brain in a vat? It actually makes it less likely that you're not a brain in a vat. It makes it more likely that you are. So that's just to say that you're using this evidence to prove that you're not a brain in a vat or to come to know that you're not a brain in a vat doesn't seem like it should work, because it actually makes it more likely that you are a brain in a vat. So that's all to say. I think that the dogmatist response conflicts with some prima facie, it conflicts with some well-known established principles of confirmation theory. Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, so we can deal with the subtler responses in discussion if we want to. I've got those written out there, so you can take a look at them. Let's just jump to the last section, which says, well, why don't we just reject closure? So it looks like we've got this closure principle, we've got these putative counterexamples to it, we've got some ways of trying to accommodate, or we've got some way of trying to deal with these counterexamples. And I've argued that neither one is ultimately satisfactory. So why don't we just go where the thought experiment leads and just say, well, gosh, closure sure looked like a plausible principle, but I guess it's not true. We found some counterexamples. Let's abandon it. Okay, well, let me give you the kind of rejoinder that keeps epistemologists up late at night, which is this. I say, suppose we want to say that Bill knows a lot. He knows that his car's in the parking lot, but he doesn't know that his car hasn't been stolen or driven away in the last hour. Okay, so he knows the first proposition, but he doesn't know the second one that it entails. Okay. Here's the problem. What about their conjunction? Okay, what about the proposition that my car is in the parking lot and it hasn't been stolen or driven away in the last hour? Okay. What about that? Does he know that conjunction or doesn't he? Well, there's two possibilities. Either he does or he doesn't. Let's suppose that he does. Well, then the denier of closure, the person who thinks that the closure principle is false, is going to have to say, Jack knows this conjunction, right? He knows that his car is in the parking lot and it has not been stolen and driven away in the last hour, but he doesn't know that his car has not been stolen and driven away in the last hour. He knows the conjunction, but he fails to know one of the conjuncts. Oy, that's hard to swallow. That's just seems crazy to say he knows the conjuncts. He knows the conjunction, but he doesn't know one of the conjuncts. Okay, so, well, I guess that leaves the other possibilities. We could just say he doesn't know the conjunction, okay, precisely because he doesn't know one of the conjuncts. Okay, so Bill knows his car is in the parking lot, but he doesn't know that his car is in the parking lot and it hasn't been stolen and driven away in the last hour. And the reason he doesn't know that conjunction is because the reason he's ignorant of that conjunction is because it's infected with his ignorance of its second conjunct. Okay, it's because he doesn't know that his car hasn't been stolen and driven away in the last hour. Okay, in the last paragraph, I'm going to more or less read just because I want to make sure I state this correctly. I see, so it might seem that somewhat more plausible to say that Bill doesn't know the conjunction of these two propositions, which I call what and NS. The problem for the denier of closure, then, is to plausibly explain why Bill doesn't know it. Doing so is more difficult than it initially seems. For suppose the denier of closure were to say that Bill doesn't know this conjunction because Bill doesn't know not stolen. He doesn't know one of the conjuncts. And suppose that the general idea here is that if there's some proposition P that you don't know, then you don't know any conjunction of which P is a conjunct. That's the general principle. The problem here is to explain the rationale for that general principle. For if the denier of closure were to defend it by saying, for example, that if you know a conjunction, then you know you would have to know or be in a position to know each of the conjuncts, then she would be tacitly appealing to an instance of the very principle she rejects. Namely, that knowledge is closed under known implication. Okay, thank you very much for your time. Sorry to go a little long. Yes, sir.
Well, I just wanted to point out as you were talking that last example, it seems like you have a paradox, because if the car's been stolen, it's not there, so the conjunction would be it's there and it's not there.
That's right. I was imagining that the second conjunct is that the car is there because it has not been stolen and driven away, right? Yeah, but that's...
Someone could have stolen it from back there.
And that's back.
Yeah.
Back, so.
What about that case?
It gets weirder.
It does get weirder. Yeah, I'm inclined to think that if someone stole it in the interim and then returned it, you don't know either proposition. I'm inclined to say it would be true that my car is in the parking lot where I left it, but I wouldn't. I think this is actually one of these cases that Gettier described.
It just fooled you into believing, you know.
Yes, that's right. I think your evidence isn't sufficient to count as knowledge, but it's a tough case, so I don't know if everyone would have that intuition.
Two things. One thing is like with the zoo example. Well, maybe not the zoo example, but something similar, where somebody say fakes it. But they put enough characteristics into their fake that maybe it is what they're faking. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, like, when you're in a position where you've got to make a decision, like, you know, you're in Antarctica or something and the wind's blowing and you presume that there's, you know, a camp, you know, a little mile away, you've got to make a decision. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that you've got to act on probability. Mm-hmm. And this thing. So, like, maybe the probability that Bill's car is in the parking lot is, like, you know, 99%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's got to act on something. So, those two things,
that's
I
right.
guess.
Yeah. Well, with the first point, I guess if let's imagine that it's genetically modified paint that they're spraying on this poor animal, and it's such that it gets in and it actually somehow it gets into the genetics of the animal. Boy, I don't know what about oats. I'm not a metaphysics person, so would that be a zebra if it had zebra DNA that supplanted its donkey DNA? I don't know. Maybe it could first, yeah. In that case, your belief that these are not cleverly disguised mules would it be true or false? I guess that's the question. There's a prior sort of metaphysical set of issues that we have to settle before we consider only epistemological ones. So in all these cases, you notice I've been stipulating, Bill's car is actually in the lot. I've been stipulating what's true, so we can then worry about whether or not you know it to be true. In this case, I don't know what the truth would be. Actually, I have to run that by one of my philosophy colleagues. Could you change the species of an animal by just swapping out its DNA?
It has to be animals, it'd be something else.
Sure, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, a table can become a sculpture or something. It can become a non-table if you just kind of modify it enough. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, then the other question was, there are cases where it looks like you just have to act. And it looks like the way you should act, the way it's rational for you to act, is to act on the basis of the best epistemic probabilities. And certainly in these cases, I mean, there's no debating that the odds of my car being stolen are low. I don't know much about this neighborhood, but I'll go out on a limb, and it looks safe enough. I mean, I think the odds of my car having been stolen last hour are astronomically low, probably. If we want to see how low we actually think this is, we can have an auction on the insurance on my car. And I bet I could get an insurance policy pretty cheap.
Of course, it depends on the make of your car.
Yeah, it's a Honda Civic, so really cheap.
Okay. You're probably sick.
Right. So, you know, so it looks like the odds are pretty small. So, you're touching on actually too big of an issue for me to address briefly. I mean, in fact, it was too big for me to address at all. But one of the things that people who are working in this area are trying to do is to think about the way epistemology and action theory interact. And so they've said things like, one of John Hawthorne's examples is something like this. It looks like you know you're going to be, say, in London tomorrow, but do you know that the plane isn't going to crash on the way? It looks like, again, whether or not the plane crashes is a purely probabilistic thing, like whether or not your car has been stolen, and if you don't think you can know whether or not your car has been stolen without specific evidence to that effect. If you don't think you can know whether or not your lottery ticket's a loser without specific evidence to that effect, then it looks like you also shouldn't know whether or not the plane is going to crash without specific evidence to that effect. It looks like you've got good probabilistic reason to think that it won't crash, and so on. But then it might make sense for you to take out an insurance policy, right? Even if it's a really tiny, cheap one or something. I mean, I don't think it would make sense for me to, suppose I don't have life insurance and I'm getting ready to get on the plane and someone says, hey, I'll insure you, your family for $1 million in exchange for a $5 premium. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it would still actually, the odds of getting a wreck are really, really low. Maybe that's still a bad bet. What if he says $10 million for one penny? Okay, I think it would make perfect sense for me to spare a penny to buy that insurance policy. But look, if I know that I'm going to be in London, right, that's a bad policy to buy because it doesn't entail that I know that that's a useless policy, so even a penny is wasted. So it's that interaction between action, what it would be rational to do in circumstances, and what you know, right, this epistemological question, which is where a lot of the action is at in this field, and people are using these kinds of questions to try to shed a little light on what's going on the epistemology side by looking at it from the action theoretic side. So that's actually kind of what I'm trying to bone up on in my own reading on the topic. So I don't know how it all is supposed to shake out. I don't think there's a lot of unanimity. I certainly don't know how to use these practical considerations to settle the epistemic ones. But I think that's a very fruitful kind of way to go about thinking about this. Yes, sir.
Just reminds me of, you know, we know that the more food you eat, the bigger you are.
Uh-huh.
But then Harvard spent a few $100 million to follow around 125,000 women for 25 years. And the first thing they pulled from the data is the more you eat, the thinner you are.
Yeah. We can say, I know.
And then there's a couple of dozen studies on people who reduced calories and found out that the average person that reduces calories gains 15% of body mass.
Mm.
And it wasn't until... It wasn't until Benoit Mandelbrot came along that we realized why this is so. We had to invent a new math because simple thermodynamics does not predict results in complex chaotic systems. So it's not only... What we think we know is not necessarily following empirically what's out there. Oftentimes it's just our logic process which is faulty.
That's true. This is another one of these cases why, this is another one of the reasons why I try to build as much stipulation into the cases as possible.
There was a reaction to the Harvard study that said that somebody actually got published. It was in a journal of nutrition that said that, well, you know, the reason that thin people, that fat people eat less is because you know how the fat people lie. So it's like, and that got published, and I was like, amazing that they didn't understand the math, so they made up their own rationale for it.
Let no one say that political correctness is keeping people from getting published. I think that, in that kind of a case, there's a real dispute here about what was or is known, or what in fact is true, actually. So we have sort of two disputes. I mean, it sounds like the status of the research is still a little bit up in the air. And so
based on that, the government sued all of the calorie reduction plans. That's why they always say results not typical. Typical result is plus 15% of body mass.
Gosh.
So if you actually call them up and ask them, they'll tell you the typical person gains 15%.
Yikes.
But you know, they still let them advertise this crap. That's amazing.
Right. Yeah, interesting. You know, yeah, there are a lot of these cases where it's hard, you know, the status of the evidence, our access to it, and so on, is sufficiently vague that it's hard to know how to relate to that, to these kinds of general philosophical principles about when
right,
you know the
same way that Euclid disproved, I mean, Einstein disproved all of Euclid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the three angles of a triangle don't equal 180 degrees if space is curved.
Right, right. Yeah. Disprove Euclid as a description of physical space or something. Yeah.
Right, it's just totally invalid. But you can still use it to, you know.
Well, it's conditional. If your conditions are, you know, the rectilinear constructs that Euclid was working on, then it still works.
Yeah, it's
a nice trick. If you try to map it out on, say, a sphere like the Earth, or, like you say, curved space,
I'm sorry, I'm missing hands. Do you,
Ed?
Sorry, here and then here, how about?
Okay. Let me ask you first a rich question.
Sure.
Am I right when I take it that the discussion that you have given tonight is a description, simplified, of the actual kinds of discussions that go on in the community that you are a participating member, publishing, and dialoguing?
Yeah.
These are the kinds of things that are actually under discussion, essentially with this kind of, that you represented them in simplified but suitably accurate kinds of arguments.
Yeah, I would describe this as a very hot topic within a not horribly narrow slice.
Well, but then I find myself in the position of some of your freshmen who are thinking about talking about. So let me tell you where I am.
Okay.
After a considerable amount of my life being passionately interested in epistemology and logic and philosophy. Well, instead of jumping in and making a summary conclusion, which I've decided three times or so now is not right, I would rather present it in terms of a question asking you to refute
okay. The
thinking that I have. John, before that, I would like to take a slightly different approach and say, going back probably before Aristotle, but we have him as a reference. Knowledge was defined to be justified true belief. What's the function of the word true?
I don't have a fancy theory here. I'm naive about truth. I just think there's a difference. I think it's true that we're in Dallas. I think it's
all of the examples that you talk about here, and all of the thinking that you talk about, you look at what I will, for an abbreviated reference, say a God's eye view of an impartial reality.
Yes.
P entails Q as a matter of material fact. What Joe knows is a matter of empirical fact. It relates to something unspecified, but it's something very definite about what goes on in Joe's head, his relationship to his head and the world, but it's something about Joe. And yet everything here never gets in touch with the materiality of anything, because that's where truth lies. People talk about want for knowledge, and epistemology is understood as a generation-long pursuit of what justification could amount to assure the truth. So if justification can assure the truth, we can eliminate it from the definition. And they would like to do that as soon as they find the sufficient justification, which they never will.
because they haven't got in touch with truth, and that's actually been pretty generally accepted ever since Kant locked the noumenon away in Al Gore's lockbox in preparation for the later edition of Social Security. You can't get into that lockbox, so you don't know anything about the materiality. What you do know is that there are 36 different kinds of warrant in common use, and you've trotted them out. Probability is one of them. The parsing of logical verbal formulations subject to a caveat about equivocation, which is a matter of empirical falsification or material checking. Whether you have equivocation.
Do you mean empirical checking?
You can look at empirical, but you can also, whether or not there's really an equivocation there will be a material fact, not just. Okay? And so the only argument that makes sense is what warrants make sense. And you combine a lot of different kinds of warrants. Joe knows something about where his car is in the parking lot, every one kind of warrant. There are other kinds of things in the first Gettier example. About all the things that are included in his warrant. And there's never enough to include in the warrant. Yet the argument goes on as if you were on Alice's other side of the looking glass. And to me, there's a lot, if that's the serious argument that goes on, there's lots of grounds for dropping the course. Tell me why there is serious ground to have the argument in the form you presented.
There are a lot of ideas in your... there's a lot of comments there. And I'm
willing to let you pick apart any of them, but this probably isn't the place. If you can see your way to a hurdle that I can think about.
I mean, it sounds to me like your basic complaint is that there's a lot of stuff I haven't resolved. So, for example,
there's a lot of stuff I've never seen or heard resolved.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like...
And it ought to be mentioned. There ought to be a continuing discussion about stuff that's not resolved. That's why I asked you, what is going on in the community that takes this stuff seriously?
Well, a lot of things are going on simultaneously.
Sure.
And one of them is a debate about the nature of epistemic justifications, warrant, whether those are two things, the same thing, and so on. There's a career in philosophy. One is what's truth, career in philosophy. One is trying to think of some of the other things you mentioned, like are all facts that are knowable, empirically knowable, or is there any such thing as substantive a priori knowledge?
Yeah,
career in philosophy. So, in 40 minutes, I pick and choose. And what I have sort of tried to do is introduce, these principles, some counterexamples to them. And I haven't resolved a lot of these issues that you're interested in. Which I can only say, I can only plead limited time, I suppose, and limited knowledge, of course.
I think you've done very well at covering a lot of the material that goes on to make it comprehensible to a course, an introductory course in epistemology, in a philosophical
I guess my advice...
I'm trying to see past that.
Yeah.
Because
I guess my advice would be, if it didn't tickle your fancy, there's a lot more going on.
I also would concede that in any community, in any department of this scope, people will pick a piece of the problem and work upon it in isolation. And that's a lot of what's going on.
That's exactly what's going on. Yeah.
Let me say one more thing about what has influenced a lot of the ethics. And it's a book I'm sure you're quite familiar with. Benson makes three skeptical essays in which he covers a lot of wonderful ground.
I know of them.
I haven't read them, actually. And one of his conclusions was philosophers will continue never to resolve these things because they really enjoy playing games. I can understand that also.
The most charitable interpretation of one's intentions, but okay, let's go back to some other comments from Corey.
Thank you for your time. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to come. The one thing that you did talk about in the example of the lottery ticket, the person felt like this is a winner. I think you actually used that word. I feel like I've got the winner right here. Now, in epistemology, you would agree that feelings are not tools of cognition?
No, I would not want to go there.
Well, that's pretty basic. I mean, to say feelings are tools of cognition, yes or no?
Oof. You know, I think that there are a lot of times when what we might call feelings are things like biases, are things like prejudices, are things like phobias that I don't
think. They come from your thoughts. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Feelings come from your thoughts.
Yeah. And vice versa. I think a lot of times your thoughts come from your feelings. And the question is whether that's ever, whether you can get knowledge through that. Now, I'm married to a marriage and family therapist, so we had interesting conversations. She's big on gut feelings. My wife is a big believer in the
as if your gut is a tool of cognition.
Yeah.
We think of your brain and reason.
Yeah, and there's some interesting. If you know Joe Dallaire, the neuroscientist, he's on NPR and things a lot. He's like 25. He's one of these people who makes me feel so poorly, you know, underaccomplished. He's a Rhodes Scholar who is basically, he's kind of a popularizer of work in neuroscience. And he's done a lot of work on this stuff and on how, in effect, there's a lot of sort of precognitive activity in the brain that's capable of generating action without conscious reflection. And so there's a way in which reflexive reactions to things can actually be clues to some subconscious process that actually is cognitive, that's going on, although it's not accessible to consciousness. So I don't know what the philosophical upshot of all this is exactly, but I think, you know, someone like my wife could take that as good, hardcore scientific evidence that things like gut feelings often can have at their core some connection to a real objective subject matter that's, you know, giving them a window of truth. My wife wouldn't be surprised by this at all, because she feels like this happens again and again, where her gut feelings are vindicated again and again and again in clinical practice. So, Laura, should I have a gut feeling about a situation?
The other question is, a note, that it seems like in the examples of the car, of the zoo, you're saying that knowledge is equal to or should be compared to omniscience, right? That I should know through some godlike omniscience that my car, and that's the definition of knowledge. Yeah. Or I should know everything about the zebra, the DNA, and so if you can't know that, I'm sorry, you can't trust your senses.
Right.
Going back to the car, you know, you're not dreaming, God's tricking you.
Right. Right.
So skepticism, circle, hell.
Here we still are. Years later, after Descartes. I think you're raising a very big. This is an important point, and it's one that actually people have tried to deal with rigorously in the subject in a way that I wasn't able to cover tonight. But here's how I try to reformulate your question to make sure I'm not putting words in your mouth. But how can you say there's such a thing as knowledge and say that there could be such a thing as fallible knowledge, right? So how can you say that you can have knowledge by means that are less than absolutely deductively certain or something like that?
You're comparing it to omniscience. You're saying you have to be omniscient. Just the word knowledge.
Yeah, if I gave you that impression, I misled you. Because my own view is that in my dissertation, one of my axioms, as it were, is the view that our extraordinary perceptual beliefs are fallible. So I think that, you know, that we're having this conversation, even though that's consistent, as far as it goes, with the possibility of you being a brain and a bat and so forth. So I actually, I'm an anti-skeptic, in that I think you don't need to be able to rule out all these skeptical scenarios in order for you to have knowledge we're having the conversation. That's how I got interested in this topic, and that's how I've become. I'm actually a little pessimistic about closure. Now maybe you say, wait a minute, Lockhart, how can you be a fallibilist about where your car is? Well, why wouldn't you also be a fallibilist about whether or not it's been stolen, right? Why are you, Lockhart, seeming to demand a higher standard of certainty with respect to the entailed propositions than you're requiring with respect to the entailing proposition? Now, this is where there's been a lot of work trying to make these notions precise. So a lot of the work that's been done on this has to do with information theory and has informal sort of possible world semantics. It has to do with the distance of epistemically relevant worlds and so forth. So there's a theory around what strength of evidence is and how to evaluate the strength of your evidence, and then how to say or how to specify the conditions under which your evidence is strong enough for you to count as knowing something. So one thing that the contextualist, for example, would say is that my memory of where I left my car gives me a certain amount of evidence. It's fallible, but it's evidence that's good enough for me to know where my car is. But they would say it's not good enough for me to know that my car hasn't been stolen. Now, suppose someone comes and runs in the room and says, Matt, your car's been stolen. The contextualist would say, now your evidence is good enough for you to, but it's still fallible after all, your friend might be lying to you. Right. So there's sort of a distinction here between these issues about, so in other words, I think you can get into this literature and you can grant the basic building blocks of the puzzles without having to be a complete infallibilist about knowledge. And in fact, that's how I got interested in this topic. So, good question. Yes, sir.
So I'm wondering, is there a aspect or a branch or a group of people that do what you do that put some primacy on sense data?
Uh-huh.
I admit, my friend tells me I'm a naive realist, and I really am, in the sense that it seems like, for instance, in the car example, there's really two possibilities. It's either stolen or not stolen.
Right.
As soon as I walk around the corner, even though I know where I parked it, and millions of people get back to their car every day to their house,
right.
As soon as I walk around the corner, I don't know if it's there or not, but I can find out by turning around and going back and looking in that exact spot, and I'll either verify that it is or that it isn't, but that's based on my ability to see.
Right.
Right. But I am a probabilist in the sense that I do have insurance on my car because there is a probability that it might be stolen.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that my senses work very well because I drive about 35 miles to work every day, and other mean, hundreds and thousands of other drivers that are processing sense data that don't run into me. So I guess I'm trying to understand where there's this realm of pure ideas and, rationalism or whatever. How does it relate to the non-real world?
Good. So there is, as I understand it, the debate, there's, I guess, a couple things that could be called naive realism. I actually don't like the word naive. It's kind of, put down or something. But let's say there's lots of different views could be called realist views. And there's, as I understand it, a metaphysical one and an epistemological one. A metaphysical version of realism and an epistemological one. So as I understand it, the metaphysical realist says there's a sort of mind-independent fact of the matter is whether or not your car's been stolen. Okay, that's kind of metaphysical realism vis-a-vis your car. And then the epistemological version has to do with the sense data theory. So the sense data theorists thought that I don't perceive you. I perceive a sense datum from which I more or less infer that you're something is behind it, right? So I sort of perceive you by means of immediately perceiving my own sense data.
Well, 6 billion people on the planet live every day in relation to each other based on their sense data.
Right. Yeah, no, that's certainly true. Now, you could be an epistemological, so that's sense data theory. The epistemological realist says, I have sense experiences, but those sense experiences enable me to see you, right? I don't see you by seeing my sense experiences. The sense experiences are the way I see you, in much the same way that, so when I'm thinking about dogs, I'm using the concept of dogs, right? I'm using the concept of dogs to think about dogs. I'm not using the concept of dogs to think about the concept of dogs. I'm using it to think about dogs, the animals. Similarly, when I'm having all these perceptual experiences, I'm not a sense data theorist, so I would say I'm having all these sense experiences constitute the way I see you. They're not the objects of perceptual reference, they're the mode of perceptual representation or something like that. That's kind of the philosophical sounding way that I would try to gloss that. So I think that, so then the question is something like, do you have to have a stand on, say, the on either of these views? Do you have to have a stand on realism or anti-realism in metaphysics, or do you have to have a stand on realism versus sense data theory in epistemology to, you know, describe these puzzles the way I've been describing them or something? I have been a frank metaphysical realist, I guess, throughout this discussion. So this gentleman was reminding me, I was stipulating this, suppose this is the case. So I'm just imagining that that's unproblematic. Maybe that's offensive, but just, you know, it's your time and so on, and giving orientation to the topic. I'm not going to fight the battle over metaphysical realism. I do think you kind of have to assume metaphysical realism to get the project, get these worries up and running. As far as sense data theory goes, I think that's orthogonal to these issues. So in my opinion, I think a sense data theorist might very well worry about this stuff every bit as much as a epistemological naive realist might. I'm pretty sure that Moore, for example, was not a sense data theorist as far. Well, he kind of changed, and his views really evolved. But yeah, G.E. Moore. But you know, at least at the time that he's writing Proof in External World, I'm pretty sure he's more or less what we recognize as a naive realist. Russell was. The later Russell was a sense data theorist, and I think they would both they could both worry about these kinds of questions. So that's why I say I think that's kind of orthogonal. But the metaphysical realism is kind of at least a weak version of metaphysical realism. You at least need to sort of set up the cases by saying what's true. Again, you know, you kind of start by describing the case, and then you say, well, under such and such a circumstance, as if this is the way things are, then would we describe so-and-so as knowing that the things are that way? So you kind of have to give a description of the way things are before you can have intuitions one way or the other about the epistemological status of a person's beliefs about the way things are. So I guess that assumes that there's some sense in which the way the world is precedes our beliefs about the way the world is, at least weakly, at least sometimes. So at least, I mean, you can even say that the way our beliefs about the way the world is often influence the way the world is, often constitute the way the world is, and so on. That actually seems plausible to me.
I think we perceive every moment in many unconscious ways, mm-hmm. based on the fact that our, you know, at least at the level of physical perception, mm-hmm. our brains are working and we're perceiving things and we're reacting to it. You know, I avoid running into the guy next to me, but I'm not really thinking about it.
That's right. Yeah, well, that too, I mean, raises the point that there's a lot of cognition that is pre-belief. I mean, I think there's a lot of non-doxastic cognition, as we would say. So, yeah, I think navigating the room is exhibit A. There's some philosophers who like to rationally reconstruct everything in terms of belief. So you subconsciously believe that there's a podium in front of you and so on, or when you ducked, the ball was rushing towards you, subconsciously believe that the ball is flying towards you. I think it's a little strained. And it doesn't work very well for us.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, but I think at that sub-doxastic level, I actually think there's interesting questions about whether there's an analog of the difference between knowledge and mere true belief. I wonder if there's an analog of that between different kinds of visual perceptions and so on. That's a kind of unexplored topic as far as I know.
Thank you.
To follow up on my friend here, to me, epistemology is ephemeral. It changes. What you have given us is a tautological argument. That's all it is.
Uh-huh.
And the cure for that is very simple, as you yourself said, an empirical experience. Just go out there and see if the van car is there or not. That, my friend, is epistemology. That's knowledge. And anything other than that is not knowledge. It's a tautological Empirically valid.
So is that...
It may be true that from your axioms you have propositions that follow from it logically, and like I say, they're tautological. They're not true. They're not, epistemological.
So,
you got to have empiricism.
So let me...
But you yourself said by two hands.
Right.
You yourself said it. That's
all
there is to it.
I said it.
Well, there's for that
cause
there.
Can I ask you a question? Are you saying that all knowledge is, if for any proposition P, if S knows the P, then S knows the P empirically? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying for it to be true, it can be valid. You know, we used to teach, the difference between validity and truth.
Yeah.
It seems like today's logicians have given that up. They can talk about everything as truth. And I'm still old-fashioned. I still see the difference between a tautology and a natural empirical truth.
Oh, okay. So if P is true, then P is known empirically.
Because the tautology is just defining itself. That's all it is.
Yeah, so let me see. I'm just trying to be clear on what your view is. Is the view that if P is true, then P is known to be true by somebody or other empirically? Like, there's no
such thing. The truth is something I learned empirically.
Okay, so the truth is something you learned empirically. Did you learn that empirically? What observation confirms the proposition that for every proposition P, if P is true, then P is not empirically? That's a proposition called Q.
And mom's kidding.
Get NEH fund. Get National Science Foundation. Get funding for that. That's a philosophical claim.
You can approach statistically if you get enough.
But anyway, thank you very much.